Welcome, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Welcome back to another edition of Asia-Pacific Perspective, that monthly video series where myself and co-host Brock West of APPerspective.net go over all of the news that's making headlines in the Asia-Pacific region. Brock West, always great to have you here. Thanks for joining us again.
You know, it's always a pleasure, James. Good to be back after our little, our longer than normal break, but it's always good and there's always a lot of news to cover, so I think we should get straight into it, if that's okay with you.
Let's do it. And as you say, there is a lot to cover, so let's get straight into it.
Sure. Well, we'll start off our first story today, James, with an article that you actually brought to my attention. But we will take this one from Press TV. The headline reads, South Korea, U.S. military drill to fuel tensions. North Korea has warned South Korea and the United States against a planned military drill next month, saying the move will further fuel tensions on the Korean Peninsula. South Korea and the United States plan to conduct a military exercise next month, with the United Nations Command also getting involved. If the drill takes place, conditions in the region will become unpredictable and escalate to the brink of war, which comes from Pyongyang's ruling party, Daily, the Rodong Sinmun. Continuing on here, Seoul and Washington are scheduled to hold the annual Ulchi Freedom Guardian exercise in South Korea in mid-August. The drill is reportedly aimed at improving their defensive stance against potential attacks by the North. James, we've seen, you know, in the last couple of months an ever so slight lull in the tensions and the rhetoric coming out of the three camps. This seems to have led to a bit of a brief opportunity, at least, for both the Koreas to try and restart some kind of meaningful dialogue towards perhaps, you know, further calming the tensions between them both. And we saw this in late July with the continued inter-Korean talks about reopening the Kaesong Industrial Zone, which is bilaterally extremely significant economically and also diplomatically. Unfortunately, though, these talks broke down into name-calling and accusations, as they seem to do, unfortunately. But also in the related articles of this story, I noticed that you'll see that South Korea has just approved $7.6 million worth of aid to the North. And this is the first time since 2011 and since new President Park Geun-hye has come into office. So there still seems to be small signs of progress, I guess, between the North and South. But, you know, just as it seems things might be moving in the right direction, along comes another military drill to further provoke, you know, stoke the fires, if you will. So firstly, James, what's your take on this aid package? And secondly, you were just recently in Seoul for GRTV. So what's the feeling on the ground generally?
Well, the aid package, I guess, is better than nothing, but it's still peanuts as opposed to what I think should be happening between South and North Korea. And obviously, I think what needs to be happening in the long run is the bilateral negotiations that need to happen as I think, an adjunct to the actual peace treaty process, which supposedly has been going on for 60 years now in the war that is still officially going on between South and North Korea. It's important for people to understand that these military drills are extremely significant. In fact, some of the largest military drills in the world, and they're held twice a year. The last one we saw, of course, was in March, and that involved simulated nuclear destruction of North Korea, including B-2 nuclear armed bombers dropping dummy munitions on the Korean Peninsula. You cannot get much more blatant than that with the provocations. And then in April, when North Korea struck back with all their rhetoric about blowing up Washington and the like, suddenly it was North Korea's crazy. Where did they get all this craziness from? Because they never report on the drills. So here we are reporting the drill before it happens so that when you start to see later this month or early next month, when you start to see these crazy North Koreans going crazy again, you'll know the reason behind it, that they're under constant provocation by the largest military exercises in the world. So this is a significant part of the package. As people know, I was in Seoul, South Korea two weeks ago now for GRTV, and so that the footage of that is spilling out over the Global Research TV YouTube channel. I hope people will go there for that some of that footage. And that was all about an international symposium that was taking place in Pyongyang and Seoul and Tokyo, organizing people from around the world, but of course Koreans, to come together to actually try to put some impetus behind a peace treaty. And obviously this is the big lingering blistering sore that is the scab on the face base of the Korean Peninsula that's driving this wedge between this nation. And obviously, Washington is a big player in there that has consistently scrapped peace treaty negotiations, including in 1999. There was some progress being made. It was scrapped when Bush came in. We've seen Obama backing away from the table and trying to drive that wedge deeper. So it just continues to happen that Washington is consistently trying to drive these two nations apart, or these two countries apart. And hopefully we'll see some progress. But as you note, Kaesong is an extremely important part of this, and it's unfortunate that negotiations about the shared industrial zone have broken down, because with this aid package, you give a man a fish, he eats for a day, but if you teach him to fish, he'll feed for a lifetime. So I think Kaesong is an extremely important part of this, and hopefully we'll see some more progress on the negotiations to reopen that industrial zone.
Yeah, absolutely. I hope so as well. And I'm definitely looking forward to seeing more of what come out of that conference that you were a part of there. It looked really good. Speaking of Washington driving a wedge in the Asia-Pacific, James, we'll move on to our second story. And once again, we'll take this one from the always invaluable StratRisks.com. The headline reads, Inside Japan's Invisible Army. On paper, Japan is a pacifist nation. It ranks 6th on the Global Peace Index, a list tabulated by peace activists and at the Vision of Humanity. Japan's constitution makes a traditional standing army illegal. But a recently published defense white paper shows the extent to which the country has one of the most well-equipped invisible armies in the world. Japan's armed forces are euphemistically dubbed the Self-Defense Force. Officially, it's an extension of the police. But with the world's 6 best-equipped troops and nearly $60 billion in defense budget last year, the SDF is not composed of your average beat cops. Japan enjoyed an isolationist status until now, says Narushige Michishita, a past advisor to Tokyo on defense and now director of the Security and International Program at Tokyo's National Graduate Institute for Policy Studies. It was very convenient. We didn't have to get involved in all these conflicts, but now the US wants Japan to be more proactive. Japan's ruling party, the LDP, acknowledges this. They know we have to be commensurate with our structure as an economic superpower, he adds. The US is asking us to be more proactive in, not rearming, but making sure, but making good use of those arms. James, it was pointed out in that article that the last few decades there has been a slowly but surely increase in Japan's defensive capabilities. However, quite conveniently, you could say it still managed to maintain this image of, you know, a mostly pacifist and peaceful society, or at least militarily anyway. But with the territorial disputes between Japan and China still ongoing and the continued pivot by the United States and Washington, I think that facade is kind of slowly but surely falling away. It seems that with every new defense paper around the region, not just in Japan, but Asian Pacific nations are increasing their military budgets and capabilities faster and faster. So Japan, of course, being no exception, and with the further boost of arms export ties to the Pentagon, as was reported by Reuters last Wednesday, coupling that with the recent unveiling of Japan's largest new warship, which stated purpose is border and territorial patrols and defense, it's also not surprising to see reactionary moves from China, i.e. holding out on the recent maritime code of conduct in the South China Sea, a code of conduct that was in principle agreed to at the latest ASEAN summit, but now all of a sudden China seems to have gone cold on. So one step forward, 3 steps back, James, it seems.
Exactly right. Well, I like this Invisible Army post because it does a good job of pointing out the discrepancy between Japan's international image and what it's actually doing. And this is something that I've remarked numerous times, that I've never seen a population that has pacifism really drummed into them from an early age. And everyone you meet on the street is very much a pacifist. Except in the political arena, it's completely the opposite. And you have this rabid militarism rising with the Abe administration, but of course it's been there simmering under the surface for much of the past half century. And right now, of course, we are seeing the moves toward making this actually formal and legal, and they're moving to amend the Article 96 of the Constitution, which which basically dictates how the Constitution can be changed, which is a build-up to moving towards Article 9, which is the self-defense clause, meaning that Japan supposedly can only have self-defense forces. But, of course, it has an army. It's just not an army in name, but it is an army, and it is one of the most militarily advanced in the world. And let's use this as another opportunity to point out to people that Japan is a nuclear nation, the entire nuclear program, in one sense, has been just the cover for a nuclear weapons program that could be flipped on at the flip of a switch, if and when Japan ever legalizes or formalizes its military capabilities. If and when it ever needs to use nuclear weapons, they can just flip that switch, and suddenly all of these nuclear reactors in the country are great plutonium processing facilities, and they have enough weapons-grade plutonium to make nuclear weapons. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind too. So Japan likes to play at this pacifism game geopolitically, but they are not pacifist. They do have a military, and this absolutely is playing out in the region, as you see, of course, with the East China Sea dispute, and of course what's happening in South China Sea, playing into the bigger regional role, as you say, of the Chinese Navy building up, and some of those tensions and some of the maritime disputes, which have not quite been resolved yet. So as we've been talking about since the inception of this series and even before, Asia-Pacific is the place where the military buildup is happening right now. So the military buildups of today are the military conflicts of tomorrow, and I hope people are continuing to keep their eye on this because, again, I think this is the flashpoint for future world conflict.
Exactly right, James. I couldn't agree more. And, you know, speaking of flashpoints and little things like that, in a somewhat related side note, recently an American HH-60 helicopter crashed in Okinawa. Now, from what I'm getting at the moment, no one was injured. I believe one man was killed or he's still missing. But interestingly enough, the United States military put a complete no-fly zone around the area. And the funny thing about this is that actually the United States handed over control of the Okinawa airspace only a few months ago. So these little things, you know, although this has happened in Okinawa for instance, this could happen on the Senkaku or the Aru Islands or in the Takashima Islands or anywhere really. I mean, pick your poison at the moment. In the Asia Pacific, anywhere almost in every corner, there could be a potential flashpoint. But the biggest flashpoint in the last, two and a half years, James, has to be obviously the Fukushima Daiichi situation. And you and I were speaking of this briefly before we started recording today. This is something you and I and many, many others around the world have been saying. This is such an extreme situation, but for whatever reason, just seems to be gaining traction right now. And we'll take this last story from Russia Today. Fukushima radioactive groundwater link, now an emergency. Embattled Fukushima operator TEPCO has been accused of a weak sense of crisis as its failing battle to prevent radioactive water from seeping into the seawater near the plant has become an emergency. You can't just leave it up to TEPCO, Shinji Kinjo, head of the Nuclear Regulatory Authority, told Reuters. Right now, we have an emergency. Daily, up to 400 tons of groundwater percolates into the basements of the plant, which was decimated by the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in March 2001. The seepage mixes with the water to cool down the damaged reactors before accumulating and escaping out into the Pacific Ocean. For the past 2 years, TEPCO claimed that it managed to siphon off the excess water into specially built storage tanks, but late last month admitted that the toxic water was not contained. James, I don't think there's much more we can say in terms of the seriousness of the Fukushima situation. My only question, or should I say hope, is that the time has well and truly come for the need for worldwide assistance in this crisis to get this under control, and this needs to happen now. Obviously, very few of us can even begin to imagine the extreme difficulty in dealing with this type of situation on the ground, but collectively I'm sure that we can at least come to some kind of even slightly better scenario, because right now it is extremely bleak.
Well, it is extremely bleak, but at any rate, as you say, at least they are finally admitting it. They're finally saying, oh yeah, it's been leaking for 2 years now, and 300 tons of radioactive water a day now spilling directly into the ocean, as they're admitting. So at the very least, they finally admitted it, and now the Japanese government is saying, well, we're going to have to step in because TEPCO clearly isn't doing anything about this. So So there is some progress being made in those terms, but as you say, too little too late, and this is a ridiculous situation that really needs to be dealt with, should have been dealt with 2 years ago. So absolutely, it's a question of how and in what form and in what body claims to have jurisdiction over this and how they enact that jurisdiction. There's a lot of serious issues here that can become encoded into international law and international case precedents. So I think we have to be careful about how that proceeds. But at the same time, obviously, the major number one concern is to get this leak plugged up. And that's not going to happen with TEPCO doing it by themselves. But don't worry, they're still siphoning tons of money off of the Japanese public and still getting aid and support from the Japanese government, which is now the majority stakeholder.
That's exactly right. And since I started posting stories on FukushimaUpdate.com, it has come to my attention that some people believe that, you know, we're being scaremongers and fearmongers about the whole situation here. I would just like to point people to an article that I came across today from another one from RT. It's by Professor Christopher Bubsby, and it really breaks down, you know, the what's actually going into the what TEPCO is doing, what radioactive materials are being dissolved by the seawater, and exactly what's going into the ocean. So, you know, people can get a real much better understanding of the specifics of the situation, you should say. So I will post that up to FukushimaUpdate.com in the next coming days. So people can go there and also stay tuned to APPerspective.net for further updates regarding Fukushima and the wider Asia Pacific.
Excellent. Well, unfortunately, that is an ongoing concern, so we will have to keep our eye on it. Of course, you are posting to FukushimaUpdate.com on a regular basis, so people can keep their eyes there, and of course, APPerspective.net as well. All right, that's kind of a whirlwind tour, and hopefully it won't be so long until our next edition of AP Perspective, but in the meantime, anything else that you'd like people to keep their eyes on?
I'm not sure if anyone is aware out there, but we recently had a new election date announced here in Australia, so lucky us. So we'll have all the bells and whistles of a Western democratic election bearing down upon us. So there might be a little bit on that on Asia Pacific perspective, but as always, I do have my monthly interview with Leon Petard of Fed Ecom Radio, who I personally would like to commend on his very impressive garden. I do have a little herb garden growing at the back here at the moment as well, as a bit of an inspiration. And also, I'm doing a monthly podcast with Hanul and Mike from The Last Defense as well, so people can find the links on APPerspective.net.
Excellent. All right, well, we'll leave it there for now. And until next month, once again, it's always a pleasure. Brock, thank you for joining us.
Thanks, James. See you then.